Well, good morning, everybody. And thank you to those of you who braved the Arctic temperatures outside, made it here to the building today. Thank you to those of you who have joined us here online this morning, whether it's your first time or you've been with us for now 11 months of this whole pandemic mess. I don't have any other word that I can say for that this morning other than that. So what I need from those of you in the room this morning is I need your help as we get started in this talk this morning. I want to do a little bit of an interactive exercise. And so it's a real simple one. We're going to deal with opposites. So I'm going to say a word, and I want you to say the opposite. I want you to say it loud. I want you to say it proud. I want you to say it with no fear of being wrong, right? Can you do that? Yeah, that was not convincing. But we're going to go ahead with it anyway. All right, so it's pretty simple. Let's try this. The opposite of question is? Thank you. That was a layup, and you made it. The opposite of big? Small. The opposite of above? Below. Great. Those were simple. You want to try some harder ones? You don't really get a choice. What is the opposite of warmth? Nope. It's also not Chicago. Even though you're tempted to think that. The opposite of warmth is what, Jim? Cool. He said it in the warm-ups this morning. I went, are you kidding me? He knew that? Cool. It's actually a word. I know it is because I found it on the internet in dictionary.com, so it has to be true, right? Let's try another one. The opposite of postpone is prepone. It's actually a word. It means to reschedule something sooner than you originally planned it. And the opposite of anonymous is? No, anonymous. A book that bears the author's name is anonymous. See, now you learned something. We can just pray now and go home. This has been a fruitful morning for some of you. You won't remember it, but you've learned something. All right, now I have one more, and I don't really want a response from this, and I just want you to think about it. What's the opposite of grace? Grace is defined as getting something we don't deserve and we didn't earn. So what would the opposite of grace actually look like? In the middle of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says these words and describes what I think is the exact opposite of grace. He says, "Do not judge, or you too will be judged. For in the same way you judge others, you'll be judged. And with the same measure you use, it will be measured out to you. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank, the beam that's hanging out of your own eye? How can you say to your brother, 'Let me take the speck out of your eye,' when all the time there's a plank in your own? You hypocrite. First take the plank out of your own eye, and then you'll see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye." In this brief passage, Jesus dismantles this insidious cycle that lurks inside each one of us. When we judge, we don't judge just someone's actions. We judge them. And then, oftentimes, based on our incomplete or hasty or harsh judgment, we devalue them. And if we take that devaluing one step farther, we exclude them from our lives or our community. And that kind of judgment, that's the exact opposite of grace. All right, so we're in week 5 of this series where we're talking about getting beyond the mess of 2020, moving forward in 2021 with more spiritual power in our lives. And if we want to do that, we got to dig deeply into this whole idea of grace and what it means to have a grace-filled life instead of one that's filled with judgment. Now, the idea of grace, if you've hung around church for any amount of time, seems like a fairly easy concept. Listen to how Paul describes it in Ephesians. He says, "For it's by grace that you have been saved. You receive it through faith. It was not our plan. It was not our effort. It's God's gift, pure and simple. You didn't earn it. Not one of us did. So don't go around bragging. You must have done something amazing." It's a pretty simple concept. We don't have to earn enough bonus points to get God's grace. We don't have to live a good enough life to receive God's grace. We receive grace as a free gift from God when we place our faith in Jesus. That concept of grace is easy, but actually receiving it, that's hard, because we live in a world of limited conditional love. We say things like, "I love you because," which implies conditions, or "I love you until," which implies limits, or "I love you unless." You kind of get the idea of the limits we put on our love, the grace we extend to others. Most of us are all too familiar with that kind of love in our lives, where we're loved until we come across some kind of an arbitrary line drawn in the sand, until we go too far. All that conditional love makes it really tough for us to believe that something exists like unconditional grace from God. We feel like we don't deserve to get undeserved favor from God. Do you hear the irony in our logic? Or we feel like the deal is too good to be true. To be forgiven instantly of the worst things that I've done in my life simply because I've placed my faith in Jesus? It sounds too good. It seems too easy. Scandalously easy. And so we resist, we push back, and in our human efforts, we do our best to try to justify or earn God's grace. But if we ever want to start to live as grace-filled people, we have to embrace and understand this concept, accept God's free gift of grace. And if receiving it is hard, accepting it is harder. We receive God's grace in an instant, but learning to accept His grace can take us a lifetime. Now, I want you to think about a moment in your life right now, a recent moment when you really messed up. It's not a time for you to like point out to the person beside you when they messed up. This morning, this is like about you. When was the last time you messed up? When you did something you know you shouldn't have done, or you didn't do something you know you should have. That's, by the way, that's the Bible's definition of sin. In those moments when you failed, you feel like a failure. You've messed up big time, and it hurts. You can feel defeated, demotivated. Depending on the kind of sin you've chosen, you can feel soiled and dirty. I think oftentimes we find ourselves in that circumstance and we feel too sinful to pray, too sinful to ask God's forgiveness, too sinful to open up the Bible and read His words to us about grace. If I'm honest, there are times in my life where I feel like I deserve to be cut off from God's grace because of my own stupidity. I feel like my selfishness puts me on probation. Can you relate? Now, whether or not we have fully accepted God's grace in our lives can be determined by a really simple question. In your darkest moments, what do you think God sees when He looks at you? Truthfully, we kind of hope He doesn't see us in our darkest moments, but He does. So the question really is, what does He see? How you answer that question indicates to the level at which you've actually accepted God's grace in your life. If you've accepted a little grace, you'll feel free to confess, but you won't come clean. With a little grace, we acknowledge our sin, but we don't feel free from our past. With just a little grace, we get things off our chest, but we don't get them out of our heart or out of our life. We don't fully accept God's grace until we can say this next sentence completely with resolute certainty. It's from one of Philip Yancey's books, What's So Amazing About Grace, and here's what he writes. Some of it's familiar. Grace means there's nothing we can do to make God love us more. No amount of spiritual calisthenics or renunciations, no amount of knowledge gained from seminaries and divinity schools, no amount of crusading on behalf of righteous causes. And grace means there's nothing we can do to make God love us less. no amount of racism or pride or pornography or adultery or even murder. Grace means that God already loves us as much as an infinite God could possibly love. Isn't that beautiful? Do you believe that? Have you accepted that in your life? Is that truth anchored in your soul? So let me come back to my question. In my darkest moments, what does God see when he looks at me? I was raised in the church, and all through growing up in the church, I was taught a very simple phrase that sounded very religious. You know, we would say, "I'm a sinner saved by grace." You've heard that, right? It's not true. That's not who I am. That's who I was. Once I accepted Christ, it changed my identity. Once I accepted Christ, I'm no longer a sinner saved by grace. In fact, I challenge you, read the entire New Testament, do a word search. There is no place in the New Testament where someone who has accepted and is following Christ is called a sinner. That's not our identity. That's not who you are. It's such a key concept to our relationship with God. Now, I'm not a sinner saved by grace. I am a child of God who is deeply loved and fully, completely forgiven. That's what God sees when he looks at us. In the good times and in the rough times. That's my identity in Christ. That's who I am. That's who you are. Once we know who we are, once we know whose we are, we can give ourselves fully to God's grace. We can forgive mistakes and lapses in judgment and hurtful behavior in ourselves and in others because nobody's perfect, not even us. I can't wonder how it would change the trajectory of our lives if we stopped seeing our primary identity through our occupation, through our family, through our net worth, through our failures or our achievements. What if our primary identity in life was anchored in that simple truth? I am a child of God who is deeply loved and completely forgiven. How would it change your restless mind when you lay your head on the pillow at night? How would it change the way we relate to everyone around us if we fully embraced God's grace? If we can get that identity piece right, it makes it a lot easier to show grace to everyone else in our lives, to show grace to the people who push our buttons intentionally, the people who just can't seem to get their life together, the people who hurt us intentionally and accidentally. And I think that's the point Jesus was trying to make here in Matthew 7. Let's look at it again. Jesus says, "Don't judge, or you too will be judged." Now, that Greek word for judge has a dozen or so interpretations, depending on nuances, depending on the context it is in. In this context, what Jesus is saying is he's warning us, don't set yourself up as the ultimate judge of the people in your life. Don't judge their guilt. Don't determine their eternal fate. That's God's place, not yours. For in the same way, if you judge others, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it'll be measured to you. That's super clear. If I judge without mercy, I'll be judged without mercy, not only by others, but by God. Whatever I give will be measured back to me, ounce for ounce. So, do you want justice, or do you want mercy and grace in your life? Then Jesus offers this comical view of just how absurd it is to judge anyone. He says, "Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye?" I started laughing when I read that passage getting ready for this morning because I remembered a friend of mine an incident that he had that just illustrates this beautifully. I can't read this without thinking about my friend Bill, who was an emergency room physician when we lived near Bloomington, Indiana. Bill was out on a horseback ride with several other people, and one of the women in that group, Mary, was riding a horse that got spooked. And before she could regain control of that horse, the horse had just run full bore under a tree, hit her head on a branch, and gave her a pretty nasty gash in her scalp. Now, remember, Bill's an ER doc, so she was in pretty good hands, pretty good place for that accident to happen. So Bill took Mary to the hospital where he worked, grabbed a room in the emergency room, and proceeded to start to clean up and sew up that injury in her head. Now, as he was working on Mary, his frustration started to build. He was telling me this and laughing about it. He said, my frustration started to build because no matter how many times he asked for more light so he could see to clean and suture up the womb, the nurse just wasn't getting it right. And so he couldn't get a good view of the incision, and this normally gentle soul, Bill, had some harsh words for the nurse. He said, look, I need more light. Why can't you understand that? I don't know what the problem is, but fix it. There's this awkward silence in the room. And the nurse just looked at him and said, well, doctor, it might help if you took off your cowboy hat. That's the absurd picture that Jesus is painting here. Judgment makes us a blind doctor trying to perform an operation. How can you say to your brother, let me take that speck out of your eye, when all the time there's a plank coming out of yours? You hypocrite. First get that plank out of your own eye, and then you'll see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Jesus is just flat out condemning our inclination to judge rather than to offer grace when we see somebody else's faults, when they hurt us, when they wrong us. Jesus is calling out our tendency to severely condemn their faults and their failings while at the same time lightly passing over our own. It's a hard truth that Jesus is teaching here. And if our life is to be marked by vindictive condemnation of others, then we demonstrate that we clearly don't understand the immensity of God's grace to us. If we've truly received and accepted God's grace, if it's anchored deeply in our soul, then that grace must translate to all the relationships in our life. And so this morning, before we close, I want to give you some practical steps, some homework you can do this week to begin to show grace to others in your life. And I've adapted them from a blog I read this week that was very timely and very good. First thing we can do is forgive the fallen. Before we start slinging judgments and accusations at someone, let's take a moment and remember the grace of God that has picked us up from messes in our own life. Paul writes it this way in Colossians. He says, make allowances for each other's faults and forgive anyone who offends you. Remember, the Lord forgave you, so you might want to forgive them. It's not what he said. You may want to forgive them. Nope, you must. Second, help the hurting. Don't stand on the sidelines when somebody's struggling. We are most like Jesus when we step toward those who are suffering and extend his grace. When God's people are in need, Romans says, be ready to help them. Third, build up the bruised and the broken. Speak words of support. Fight the impulse to say to them, you kind of got what you deserved. Fight the impulse to slam them with harsh verbal or written responses. Paul's real clear on this one too. He says, let everything you say, everything, be good and helpful, so that your words will be an encouragement to those who hear. And lastly, I love this one, show grace to the loony and the lovely alike. Grace offers compassion when the world cries out for condemnation. Grace chooses to celebrate rather than complain or criticize. Always be humble and gentle. Be patient with each other, Ephesians says, making allowances for each other's faults because of your love. Rather than aiming for perfection, setting yourself up to fail this week, just pick one. One you need to work on the most and focus on that one. Begin your day asking God to help you love the loony and the lovely alike. Ask the Holy Spirit to bring that to mind when you're in a situation where that's exactly what you need to do. To show grace to someone who's loony, or someone who's hurt you, or someone who's just discouraged. Look, it's no secret that we live in a world that I feel like is largely ruled by ungrace. Our status, our identity is anchored in what we do. We have to make the shot. We have to stick the landing. We have to secure the contract. We have to beat last quarter's numbers. In everything we do, we have to win or we feel less than. And we criticize people who don't measure up. We criticize ourselves when we don't measure up. And that spirit of judgment will do nothing but poison relationships across marriages, across families, across churches, across ethnic groups, and across our nation. Jesus calls us to live a different kind of life. Kind of life where when I see my neighbor's brokenness and it's really plain to me, that I don't take that as an opportunity to judge them and perpetuate the cycle of condemnation that's in our world. Instead, it's a chance to offer the cold, clear water of grace. Grace is all about us receiving God's grace first, accepting it, and then translating it into our relationships. It's hard to consistently live that kind of grace. And we'll never be perfect at it. But we can take steps in our workplace, in our social media connections. Our sense of right and wrong wants to pull us back into that well-worn groove of judgment. But our commitment to grace needs to stay firm in the face of those challenges every single day. And if we do, we'll find ourselves over time moving closer to a grace-filled life, one step at a time. And living a life of grace that is the exact opposite of judging others.